what goes on is that the people go to the license bureau, and someone asks them, do they want to be an organ donor? And then they, if they say no, then that's not recorded anyplace. If they say yes, then somebody pushes something on a keyboard, and something shows up on their driver's license indicating that they're an organ donor, but they never even sign anything just for that, much less to be informed of the fact that after true death, there are no organs that are transplantable.
Yeah.
They always have to have a beating heart. They always have normal blood pressure. They always are in such condition that when they're cut on, they move and squirm.
Really?
Unless somebody gives them a paralyzing agent or an anesthetic to keep them from doing that.
Really?
Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them.
Disrespect welcomes Dr. Paul Byrne, a neonatologist. Where are you located, Dr. Byrne?
In Toledo, Ohio.
Okay. Not far away. And we're going to talk today on a letter published by Dr. Jaffe at the Stollery Hospital, Children's Hospital, in the journal Pediatric Critical Care Medicine, which calls specifically for a moratorium on donation after cardiac death in children. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Actually, I'm grateful to Dr. Jaffe and his colleagues for doing what they're doing, calling for that moratorium on so-called donation after heart death.
Yeah.
The moratorium should be should extend to all ages, not just children.
No, that's what he says, actually. The arguments apply equally, but he's asked for the moratorium on children, maybe because he senses that newborns are more vulnerable. Is that true?
No, I don't think that that it's that so much. It's probably that Dr. Jaffe's a pediatrician.
And, oh, I'm sorry, of course.
And so that's why we would focus more on pediatrics. But the issue is the same at whatever age, and the issues and organ transplantation are such that for an organ to be transplanted, it has to be a healthy organ.
Yeah.
And a healthy organ is obtained only from a living person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been true ever since they began to do organ transplantation.
Mm-hmm.
What has occurred from the beginning of organ transplantation, which incidentally was in 1967 when Dr. Christian Bernard did the first heart transplant.
And that was the first organ transplantation.
Yes, but 3 days later in Brooklyn, New York, they cut the beating heart out of a 3-day-old baby and transplanted it into an 18-day-old baby.
Oh.
And at the end of that day, both babies were killed.
Oh, dear.
And it was illegal and immoral.
Yeah.
And there was a great desire to do heart transplants.
Yeah.
But you can't get a heart for transplantation after the donor is truly dead.
Yeah.
And so to get around this, what they did was they got a committee together at Harvard, and the Harvard committee came up with what they called irreversible coma.
All right.
And obviously, someone in coma is living, and then they put in that little thing about being irreversible, which is one of those English words that you can only know by the opposite.
Right.
And they published the first set of so-called brain death criteria, known as the Harvard criteria, and that was in 1968. Between 68 and 78, there were 30 sets of criteria published.
Really?
Everyone became less strict than the previous one. Now, the Harvard criteria called for the donor to be in that condition for 24 to 48 hours.
Right.
So the first thing they did was shorten the time down to 12 hours, and then to 6 hours, and then to 3 hours, and then to 1 hour. And there's one set of criteria in the Cleveland Clinic Quarterly. Under certain circumstances, you can take the patient off the ventilator, and if they don't show that they have breathed in 30 to 60 seconds, that becomes the signal to cut their organs out.
Uh-huh.
Now, what has occurred more recently is that they have changed the language of the transplanters is DBD, donation by brain death.
Right.
They have changed from donation by brain death to donation by cardiac death.
You must be aware of the history of this. I'm not. When did that start, and where did it start?
Well, Wisconsin has been a leader in it, and they would even say that they have always done it. But the reason Wisconsin is a leader is because they have developed a Wisconsin score. And what the Wisconsin score is that in patients who don't fulfill any of the 30 or more sets of brain death criteria, clearly they're still living persons by evidence that their brain is functioning.
Right.
But they want to get their organs. And so what they have done is come up with this thing called donation by cardiac death. And what they do is take the patient off the ventilator for 10 minutes. And then they observe how fast they breathe, how deep they breathe, what their age is, and a couple of other things. And out of that, they call that a Wisconsin score. After that 10 minutes, they put them back on the ventilator. But the Wisconsin score then is used to predict when they will be without a pulse in 60 minutes or 120 minutes.
All right.
And not till they're without a heartbeat.
Right.
They always have a heartbeat.
Right.
But they're without a heart that's beating strong enough to cause a pulse in
okay.
their lower extremities or wherever they're measuring.
Right.
And then that becomes the signal to cut out the organs. And so what Dr. Jaffe and colleagues are calling for is a moratorium on this based on the fact that these patients are clearly not dead by anybody's criteria.
Right.
And certainly I would agree with that. On the other hand, I would call for people being informed about what's happening in organ transplantation. What goes on is that the people go to the License Bureau, and someone asks them, do they want to be an organ donor? And then they, if they say no, then that's not recorded anyplace. If they say yes, then somebody pushes something on a keyboard, and something shows up on their driver's license indicating that they're an organ donor, but they never even sign anything just for that, much less to be informed of the fact that after true death, there are no organs that are transplantable.
Yeah.
They always have to have a beating heart. They always have normal blood pressure. They always are in such condition that when they're cut on, they move and squirm.
Really?
Unless somebody gives them a paralyzing agent or an anesthetic to keep them from doing that.
Really?
Now, the person who goes to get their driver's license, when they ask them, do they want to be an organ donor, they need to be informed, just because the ordinary person, I suspect, thinks that, well, sure, after I'm dead, take my organs.
Yeah.
They don't realize that the death that's in their mind, that is the death from the caterpillar that they played with, or the death of their pet dog, or the death of their relative that they go to the funeral home for the viewing, and that kind of thing, that's somebody who doesn't have any heartbeat, doesn't have any breathing, doesn't have any response.
And doesn't have any organs worth donating by now.
But those people who are truly dead, you can't get any organs.
Right.
And so the people are those that are saying yes. They're saying yes to taking organs after what is in their mind true death.
Yeah.
They don't know how to differentiate. I think the very least that ought to happen is that there ought to be a way to inform the public about what happens in organ transplantation, that inform the public that after true death, and true death is a cadaver, from a cadaver there are no organs that you can transplant. And they need to know they're not a cadaver when organs are taken. They're always a living person when organs are taken.
We have a situation in Ontario that's a little worse than in Ohio. They assume that you want to donate your organs. And as apparently in Ohio, there really is no way to record that you do not. You'd have to have
There's
it tattooed
no good
on your
way
chest.
To refuse, and more than 40 states have already passed a presumed intent law, presumed that everyone intends to be an organ donor.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure what it is in Canada, whether it's presumed intent or presumed consent.
Mm-hmm.
It's already passed in 24 European countries,
yeah.
And here in the United States, it was introduced in Delaware last year, and this year it was introduced in New York, presumed consent, but neither time did it get out of committee, so it didn't get passed.
Oh.
And, of course, presumed consent is no consent. Presumed intent is no intent.
Yeah.
And it's all focused on getting organs when, in fact, what it ought to be focused on is protecting and preserving the life of every person. And then the law ought to be such that no one should be declared dead unless they are a cadaver.
Yeah.
You know, and what do you do with a cadaver?
Yeah.
You bury a cadaver, you embalm a cadaver,
yeah.
You can cremate a cadaver.
Yeah.
But these persons that are declared brain dead or declared cardiac dead to get their organs, they have beating hearts, they have normal color, they have normal temperature. Who would ever think of embalming them?
Yeah.
To embalm them would be to kill them.
Yeah.
And yet the people need to be informed about what's happening. And it's not an issue for just Canada. It's pretty much the same, whether it's Canada or the United States or Italy or France. It's pretty much the same. Now, the method of consent can vary.
Yeah.
But the issue, so far as the donors are concerned, they're the same. They're always living donors.
Is it the case, then, that a strong power of attorney is a defense against this kind of thing? Power of attorney for care?
I think that can be no defense. What I have observed is that the power of attorney is very strong legally, and if the power of the attorney determines that it's time for you to be dead, that can happen and nobody can intervene.
Yes.
So that what I would say should happen is, and I encourage people to fill out these little cards, I call them medical cards, and it says, I want to live the lifespan given to me by God. I don't want anybody to hasten my death. I want to have my life protected and preserved. I want nutrition and hydration at all times, and do not take any organs for transplantation. Now, that needs to be signed and dated and have two witnesses.
Right.
And in that, you can designate a person who can speak up for you, but that person can only carry that out.
Right.
So it's really not a power of attorney. It's a person who can speak to protect and preserve your life, like you would want to have your life preserved.
A legally empowered advocate, yeah.
Yeah, you can get these cards at www.lifeguardianfoundation.org.
Okay.
They're called medical cards. We send them out at no charge. Of course, we appreciate a donation if that occurs. But those little cards are the only things that I know that will protect your life. And I don't even know that they will protect your
life.
No,
that's true.
Because so much depends on attorneys and judges and and other things like that. But in the meantime, people need to be educated. They need to be fully and completely informed about what happens to the donor, what happens to the recipients. You know, we get into things like kidney transplant. Well, people with kidney disease, they can go on dialysis, so it isn't that they're without any treatment. They do have treatment.
You mentioned that can take place at home, too.
And it can be done at home, and sometimes it's done for many years. So it isn't that there's no treatment available for them. It's the same way with hearts. So often, better medical treatment for the heart. And actually, if they hadn't done this immoral thing of heart transplant, I strongly suspect that an artificial heart would have been further developed. There are several of them that have been developed and tried with a certain amount of success. But it's so easy to get a beating heart from somebody who's 19 years old and injured on a motorcycle. And who's there to defend the life of that person? Certainly the relatives that are just overcome and overwhelmed by the accident that occurs, they're not equipped to do much to do anything at that time. And so people need to learn ahead of time. They need to know what it is about organ transplantation. And, you know, my goal and objective in all of this was not to be against organ transplantation. My study of this subject for the last 30 years has been to ask the question, is brain death true death? And it is not. And there are many people from around the world that are writing articles clearly pointing out that brain death is not true death. But then what's occurred in the last several years when I've started to pay more attention to organ transplantation, I find these other things that show that for an organ to be transplanted, it must be a healthy organ. And where do you get healthy organs? It's in the people who are 16 to 30 years of age. They have the most healthy organs. And so all of those people that have a head injury, their life is in jeopardy because they go through this thing about whether you give small amounts of fluid to keep the brain from swelling or you give larger amounts of fluid to keep the kidneys and the liver in good shape. And I would certainly say it's not easy for the people that are participating in this, but they stay focused, and their focus is to keep the patient alive at all cost. And when they're doing that, they're really keeping their organs healthy, their heart, their liver, their kidneys, which is really what they're out to get.
And now a little alt country for you, Craig McCarron, Man on the Other Side.
Going? Where have you been? And what are you doing? Doing with him? It's hard to hide. Empty feeling inside. 'Cause you've got a man on the other side. Scream in the wind. What he don't know will ever hurt him. It's hard to hide an empty feeling inside. 'Cause you've got a man on the other side. Don't you ever look away. see it in your face. You know with me you never lie. She got a man. She got a man on the other side. Deep as a river, long as the night. As pain is your pleasure. Do you think that's right? Don't try and hide behind worn out disguise. 'Cause you got a man on the other side. Don't you ever look away. 'Cause I can see it in your face. You know with me you never lie. 'Cause you got a man. 'Cause you got a man on the other side. Heart is breaking, midnight storm. Sea is raging, love for long. Outside it's raining, somewhere it's raining inside. 'Cause you got a man. You got a man. You got a man on the other side.
You've been listening to Dr. Paul Byrne, a neonatologist in Toledo, Ohio, talk about the uproar caused when Dr. Ari Jaffe submitted a letter between him and seven other American physicians requesting a moratorium on death by cardiac donation from children. Chip Deutsch, a doctor at the University of Calgary and a critical care professor, is skeptical about the donation from for cardiac death concept. Yeah. And he says in the article, which appeared, was Wednesday, September 5th, National Post, front page actually, the decision to unplug patients isn't always a straightforward one. Dr. Deutsch says he's seen a number of cases where some of the treatments doctors recommended for patients be removed from life support, which would hasten cardiac death, but the individuals were kept hooked up and eventually recovered. Is there such a thing as an irreversible patient
no.
in your mind?
Well, I say offhand no because of how irreversible is used. See, we doctors can only observe certain things. For
yeah.
instance, if we shine a light in the eye and the pupil doesn't constrict, we can observe that function of constriction of the pupil is not there.
Right.
If we see an extremity that's gangrenous, that's black, we can say that the extremity is destroyed.
Right.
So we can observe a cessation of the functioning, we can observe destruction, but we cannot observe irreversibility.
Yeah.
It's not something that's within our powers. Now, we can come to some prediction of a statistical prediction, but that's all that it is. And and something that we can't observe should not be in criterion for coming to the conclusion that now in this person who is warm and normal color and normal temperature and a beating heart and blood pressure, that now is the time to cut out their organs. No, we cannot include irreversibility in that. Yet that's the way all of the brain death laws have been passed in the United States and in every country except Norway. It's been an irreversible cessation of the functioning or the function, whereas in Norway it calls for destruction of these organs.
So it's a stricter standard.
These things are known and they've been known all along. It's just that if you call for destruction of the circulatory system, the respiratory system, and the brain, and no one should be declared dead unless there is destruction of those systems, you can't get organs. All of this was all invented to get organs before true death.
So there are no organ transplants in Norway?
Do what, sir?
Are there no organ transplants in Norway?
Well, I would say that there are very few because you can't get organs. See, the organ transplanters use a term that's called warm ischemic time. Warm is normal body temperature. Ischemia means without circulation.
Right.
So warm ischemia time for a heart and liver is 4 to 5 minutes.
Wow.
Everybody that's ever taken a CPR course has been instructed that you must start this within 4 to 5 minutes.
Right.
That's because the heart gets so damaged without circulation that you can't get them back.
Right.
The warm ischemic time for the kidneys is about 30 minutes.
Okay.
So it's a theoretical possibility if one wants to accept whatever it is as seeing death, a period of time without circulation, that you would have 30 minutes to get the kidneys out. So maybe you can get kidneys. And I say it quite like that because really the way it is, it isn't that the heart stops and then we're dead. What it really is that we become dead, and when we're dead, the heart can't beat.
Yeah.
See, when we're dead, there's no breathing.
Yeah.
See, it's becoming dead first is what happens, and then we see these other evidences of absence of functioning or destruction that we know that goes along with when the biological death has occurred. Then we know these other things follow.
Yeah.
But it doesn't go the other way, and so that you and I are talking to each other by long line, and we're very much a living persons, and so we know what life is. Death is the absence of life. See, it's a negative. So you can measure life, but death is a negative. So what should the negative be? I would say no one should be declared dead unless there is an absence of the beating heart, an absence of blood pressure, an absence of breathing, and doctors in medicine don't know how to reverse this. So the word to apply to that is not the word irreversible, because that's out of our realm, but it's irremediable. That is, we don't know how to change it.
Right.
So there are words in the English language to describe what good, well-meaning people mean. But what has occurred is that in this area, they came up with these other words. And, of course, I can't go back on that. The only thing I can do is when I get a chance, I talk to you on the phone, or when I get a chance, I teach and instruct as much as I can, trying to get the people to think about it. And it's so logical. It's so logical that any deer hunter would not shoot the deer and then walk up to it and start to pick it up by the horns until he at least did some test to show that there was no evidence of life in the deer.
Right.
And what occurs in organ transplantation is that they have the clear evidence of life. That is, they have a normal color. They have a normal heartbeat.
Yeah. The article actually supports what you say. And the article is by Tom Blackwell.
and I don't know if this is attributed to him, but it's otherwise unattributed. With donation after cardiac death, the decision is made not to try to revive the heart. Also, yes. Brain death does not occur until as long as 15 minutes after the heart is stopped, meaning some patients declared heart dead could still have brain function, the doctors argue, which is a shocking statement.
That thing about 15 minutes, I don't know that that's ever been tested or worked out. Now, he might have something about that. But we do know this, that all of these patients that have this donation by cardiac death, they all have a functioning brain. They all have that. And then what occurs in some places, certainly in Wisconsin and probably in other places, is that what they do is they put a catheter, a plastic tube, in the groin and feed it up into the aorta, and it has a balloon on the end of it, and they blow the balloon up, and then they use a heart-lung machine on the lower parts of the body to keep the kidneys going and the liver going, and so they have a pink lower body, they have a blue upper body, but they put that balloon in there so that the heart doesn't beat better, so that they don't wake up when they perfuse them. I mean, these things are going on. The general public is kept from knowing these things.
Yeah.
And I find them out only because I read and I pay attention. And the little baby in 1975 who had flat brain waves, and 2 days later they were still flat, and it was suggested to stop treating him. I kept treating him, and eventually he got off the ventilator. He went to school. He got straight A's. He ran track. He's married, has 3 children. He's a paramedic. He was the little baby that started my study of brain death, and after reading and studying, I realized that brain death is not true death. It never was and never will be, and this thing about donation by cardiac death is much, I want to say worse, but it's all bad. But these people all have a clearly functioning brain, and yes, they should have a moratorium on donation by cardiac death, and yes, the moratorium should involve a complete investigation of the organ transplantation industry so that the public gets informed about what's happening.
All right. So that address for that card again was
www.lifeguardianfoundation.org. LifeGuardianFoundation.org. Yeah, 3 W's, LifeGuardianFoundation.org, and request the medical card.
Good. Well, I appreciate your time to discuss this issue, which has come up in Quebec as a euthanasia issue and has come up in Calgary as an organ donation issue, but it's always the same issue. It's who decides when you're dead.
Yes.
Sadly.
Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and keep up the good work, and we ask to God to bless you and me and all of your listeners. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dr. Byrne.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dr. Paul Byrne, a neonatologist in Toledo, Ohio, talk about the uproar caused when Dr. Ari Jaffe submitted a letter between him and 7 other American physicians requesting a moratorium on death by cardiac donation from children. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the articles we read to you, but we credit the newspapers from which we take condensations or abridgments of the articles. From the Globe and Mail, Friday, September 24th, "Thousands March to Protest Pension Changes," by Jenny Barchfield in Paris. Tens of thousands of French workers took to the streets for the second day of nationwide strikes this month to protest French President Nicolas Sarkozy's plan to raise the retirement age to 62, with union walkouts crippling planes and trains and closing schools across the country. The strikes are seen as a test for the conservative Mr. Sarkozy and are being watched elsewhere in Europe as governments struggle to rein in costs with unpopular austerity measures. Labor leaders urge people to march in even greater numbers than during the last round of protests on September 7th, which brought at least 1.1 million people into the streets.
An increasing number of French people understand that the reforms the president is trying to impose will not solve the pensions issue. Martine Aubry, the head of the opposition Socialist Party, told journalists at the Paris March. Pensioners will pay the price for it, and tomorrow young people will not benefit from government-funded pensions. Walkouts disrupted travel and commutes across France. And post offices and even opera houses were hit too. Traffic was snarled in France's cities, with fewer than half of the Paris metro's lines working normally, according to the RATP public transit network. And about half of France's long-distance trains were cancelled, according to the SNCF state-run rail system. The main teachers' union said over 50% of teachers were expected to strike, though the education ministry put the figure at just over 25%. And at the SNCF National Railway, about 38% of employees heeded the call to strike, according to the management. Even at 62, France would have one of the lowest retirement ages in Europe. Closer to home, at least politically, the Globe and Mail, Thursday, September 16th, McGuinty's foes get lift from BCHST woes. Once upon a time, Ontario's Liberals were pleased that Gordon Campbell was following their lead by harmonizing federal and provincial sales taxes. What Mr. McGuinty's Liberals didn't count on was that the HST's introduction would be so spectacularly mismanaged in BC and the results so explosive. Mr. McGuinty tried to put a positive spin on the surprise announcement that BC's HST would be put to a provincial referendum, and he may well be right that Ontario will have a competitive advantage in attracting investment if it keeps the HST, which provides savings to industry, while BC scraps it. But in terms of competing in next year's provincial election, the advantage from the BC circus will likely go to Mr. McGuinty's opponents. Even before the announcement of the referendum, the backlash in BC likely played some role in prompting Premier Greg Selinger to rule out harmonizing in Manitoba. And it has prompted a parade of commentators to complain Ontarians are underreacting by comparison. There's also the fact that it newly affects restaurant meals in BC, which were already subject to provincial sales tax in Ontario. But in large part, the discrepancy has to do with BC's spectacularly clumsy rollout. The silver lining for Mr. McGuinty is that he's been able to point out to nervous members of his party how much better he's handled the issue. But that could be small consolation next year. Any campaign day spent talking about the HST will be a day Mr. McGuinty would rather be talking about something else. And courtesy of Mr. Campbell, he'll likely have a few more of those days. And from the Canadian Press via the Toronto Star, James Keller, the reporter, target of HST recall to Vanderzom, gets stuffed. Bill Vanderzom is vowing to launch a new recall campaign every month, beginning in the new year, unless the Premier bows to his demands. He and Chris Delaney, co-organizers of the Fight HST group, released a manifesto listing 18 Liberal politicians they intend to target in recall campaigns, including 5 Liberal cabinet ministers and the Speaker of the Legislature. The Premier is not on the list. I think Mr. Delaney is a bully, quite frankly. He's not going to be satisfied until he gets his way, like a petulant child, and as far as I'm concerned, he can get stuffed, said Kamloops Liberal backbencher Terry Lake, who's on the recall list. Vanderzom said the first 3 recalls will begin in January in the ridings that have recruited the most canvassers by November 15th. Then his group will carry on down the list, launching a new recall every month. The former social credit politician said how long that continues will be up to the Premier. Vanderzom is demanding the Campbell government hold the HST referendum this year rather than next year as planned. And Toronto Star, Jane Tabor in Ottawa, Ottawa's New Deal for Injured Veterans. The Harper government has announced new measures to help Canada's most severely wounded soldiers one day before Parliament resumed and the divisive issue was expected to become a flashpoint again. Defence Minister Peter McKay and Veterans Affairs Minister Jean-Pierre Blackburn held a news conference Sunday to detail the enhanced benefits, which they say will cost $2 billion over the program's lifetime. Included in that is $200 million over the next 5 years for veterans who can't go back to work because of their injuries. There is no higher standard of civilian responsibility for a government than to treat those veterans who have put it all on the line, Mr. McKay said. Mr. McKay and Mr. Blackburn did not indicate whether the system of lump sum payments would be continued or stopped, but said more announcements are on the way. The minister said that over the next 5 years, more than 4,000 will benefit from new measures. The measures include a lifeline, a lifetime $1,000 monthly stipend for 500 veterans who are severely injured and not expected to work again. These are veterans with physical as well as mental injuries. This is in addition to what they receive under the new Veterans Charter that took effect in 2006. They could receive up to a maximum of $2,600 a month. As well, more than 3,500 other seriously injured veterans are expected to be eligible for permanent monthly allowances, which will vary from $536 to $1,609 under expanded and revised eligibility criteria. All of the money is taxable. Retired Colonel and Veterans Ombudsman Pat Stogren said that while he is encouraged by the government's decisive move, he's still concerned about the threshold used by bureaucrats to determine who is eligible. The department can say, "I'm sorry your wounds aren't serious enough to warrant this." That's the kind of shenanigan the system places on our veterans, he said. They set the bar as high as any insurance company in Canada in the interests of preserving the public purse, when the legislation actually directs it should be liberally interpreted. He said the system is still broken, severely broken. There's a big black machine out there, a black hole of bureaucrats that have a culture of deny, 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 like an insurance company. Mr. McKay denied that the new measures were provoked by Colonel Stogren's frustrations. The ministers also said this is just the first in a series of announcements they will be making over the next few weeks about benefits for Canadian veterans. And from the free newspaper 24-Hour News, Monday, September 20th, a $2 billion boost for anyone badly hurt on Canadian military missions falls short of helping less injured or emotionally scarred soldiers, says the head of a GTA area veterans group. After the federal government pledged to increase pensions for those left seriously injured, Captain Wayne Johnson, 52, welcomed the aid, saying there are some good things with veteran affairs, and I hope this is the beginning. Given the timing, I hope this isn't some grease on the axle to calm down the criticism or window dressing, Johnston said in an interview, referring to accusations that the government had shortchanged veterans. The Whitby area resident, who for 2 years as a reservist helped repatriate Canadians killed in Afghanistan, said there are still many disparities. I thought the Canadian way was universality of care, Johnston said, but while focusing on vets with missing limbs and other debilitating battle scars, the founder of Wounded Warriors said the government continues to lowball pleas to provide reservists with equal benefits, better trained soldiers to return to civilian life, or provide better pensions for those who are not wounded. We've established what a pair of legs are worth. What about a person's soul, he said, urging taxpayers to continue lobbying their MPs. Again, the Toronto Star, Murray Brewster, the Canadian Press. Veterans critic likely target of smear campaign, PM says. Prime Minister Stephen Harper acknowledged an outspoken veterans critic was likely the target of character assassination after private medical information about him was widely circulated within the federal bureaucracy. But Harper blamed the privacy breach on the previous Liberal government. Documents obtained under the Privacy Act by veterans advocate Sean Bruyer suggest he was the subject of a smear campaign after a falling out with bureaucrats as they pushed through a major overhaul of veterans' benefits in 2005 and 2006. Harper called the actions completely unacceptable but turned aside calls for further investigation, saying the government will cooperate with an existing probe by the federal privacy watchdog. The Privacy Commissioner will receive nothing but the full cooperation of this government to ensure these kinds of things do not happen again, Harper told the House of Commons. A briefing note prepared for former Veterans Affairs Minister Greg Thompson in March 2006 was laced with medical and financial information about Bruyer, including a quote from a psychiatrist's letter. Privacy experts called it a flagrant breach of the country's privacy laws and an attempt to destroy the former military intelligence officer's credibility. Bruyer, who provided the documents to the Canadian press and gave permission to cite them, requested information about himself from Veterans Affairs as part of a battle with the department over his treatment. The largely uncensored records, more than 14,000 in total, included information not only about his request for more services, but comments about his advocacy work on behalf of other injured vets. And now a short break with Craig McCarron again. I know I played some Craig McCarron recently. Apologies to listeners if this is something I played before, but the album's no longer available in the library, and I don't have my playlist with me. The album Craig McCarron, the song Hearts Been Lyin'.
Don't be naming any names when your heart goes up in flames. This old love affair ain't going anywhere. My heart's been lying, it's true, and you've been trying to get me to say the word you wanna hear. I've been down that street so many times before, but you won't hear me knocking at your door. She's out there somewhere, someone else tonight, the neon sign burning
This story from the Hamilton Spectator, Wednesday, August 25th. I've held it because I didn't know what to say about it. The title says it all, Man Falls to Death as Police Probe Hit and Run. A 65-year-old Hamilton man is dead after he apparently jumped from his 10th-floor apartment as police investigated a hit-and-run crash. By all appearances, because we've got no other evidence to suggest otherwise, he has jumped, said Acting Staff Sergeant Debbie Wilkie. Police were investigating a hit-and-run car accident at King and Dundurn Streets when they arrived at the man's residence before he leaped, she said. I don't have to remind listeners, I hope,
This is the second time in about a year that police investigating a crime with a suspect in a high-rise have had occasion for the suspect to jump to his death. This from the Globe and Mail. Ingrid Peritz in Montreal. Brains and brawn no longer enough for aspiring officers. The aspiring police officers can pass their physicals and answer the ABCs of taking down a criminal suspect, but can they demonstrate they're not sexists or bullies? In a bid to meet the demands for a kinder, more professional police officer, Quebec's Police Academy has introduced a psychological test designed to weed out problem candidates before they get a badge and a gun. The test is intended not just to catch wackos itching to be in uniform, as one expert said. It's meant to suss out anyone with the potential for unseemly conduct. We want to detect behavior that's unprofessional, candidates who might use excessive force, those who show sexist or racist attitudes, said Pierre Saint-Antoine, a spokesman for the École nationale de police in Nicolet, Quebec. All major Canadian police forces use some kind of psychological screening for cadets. In Quebec, where would-be officers attend training school before they can get hired, the new testing goes further by statistically predicting the likelihood of trouble down the road, according to the Police Academy. It comes as Canadian police forces face growing pressure to respond to ethnic diversity and adopt a less brass-knuckles approach to policing. We're not just looking for people with high IQs, but people with a capacity for emotional intelligence, which is the heavy tendency nowadays in police services, says Jean-Guy Gagnon, deputy chief of the Montreal Police. Said Dorothy Cotton, a correctional psychologist in Kingston, Ontario, and expert on police psychology, when you look at traditional policing, it's very much an almost paramilitary kind of culture. Police pretty well only speak to other police. They don't really interact with the public, she said. But the world has changed. Policing and public safety now is a much more community activity. The stakes for good psychological evaluations are high, she said, because at the end of the day, these are guys who carry guns. And from the Globe and Mail, Death by Segregation, an editorial. After the jailhouse suicide of 19-year-old Ashley Smith in 2007, it should be unacceptable to put the seriously mentally ill into long-term solitary confinement in the federal prison system. But it is still happening, according to a report from Howard Sapers, the Correctional Investigator of Canada, who serves as ombudsman for federal inmates. And as long as it does, there will be other Ashley Smiths. Ms. Smith's death should haunt Canada. She was a deeply disturbed youth who at 15 was thrust into New Brunswick's criminal justice system because her family hoped she would get the help she needed. The province's mental health system had simply not been up to the challenge. Once in youth custody, she committed more offenses, primarily assaults against guards, and wound up serving a federal sentence in adult prison. The system coped with her wild behavior by shutting her inside a segregation cell, 6 feet by 9 feet, for 11.5 months without a book to read, a mattress to lie on. She hung herself while guards watched under orders not to intervene. The system has yet to learn the lessons of Ms. Smith's death, Mr. Sapers reported. Mentally ill prisoners being held in long-term segregation, beyond 60 days, still are not independently and expertly monitored. Chronic self-harming offenders with serious mental health issues are still subject to a disproportionate number of involuntary placements in segregation. As it stands now, the Correctional Service investigates itself and keeps secrets. Reports of his inquiries into suicides are not made public, not even to family members. Reviewing 4 CSC reports of in-custody death, Mr. Sapers found their recommendations inconsistent with the seriousness of the deficiencies. He wants an independent medical expert to sit on the boards that do investigate in-custody deaths, and he wants the reports of their findings to be made public. After the death of Ms. Smith, the Canadian government should insist that transparency be the rule. And from the Canadian Press,
lawsuit filed over ER waiting room death. You recall on Disrespect there was another news item about this a while ago. The family of a man who died after spending 34 hours waiting for treatment in a Winnipeg emergency room has filed a civil lawsuit. The suit, filed by Brian Sinclair's sister, Esther Grant Joyce, names the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority, its vice president, Brock Wright, the government of Manitoba, and 13 individuals, all but one medical staff working when Sinclair died. Sinclair, 45, an Aboriginal man who used a wheelchair, had gone to the emergency room to get treatment for a bladder infection. His death made national headlines and raised concerns about the quality of ER care and treatment of Aboriginal people by the healthcare system. First up, welcome to Scooterville. They're everywhere downtown. Weekend festivals see a growing number of them. Visit the food court at Jackson Square and you'll find them in droves. During a walk from a metered parking spot to the front door of Shoppers Home Healthcare at King Street East in Ferguson, four scooters fly by. This is Scooterville, laughs Lorraine McGillivray, a sales clerk in the store. They live on their scooters, believe me. If they could sleep on them, they would. Sometimes mishaps are deadly. A 91-year-old man was killed after falling off his scooter while driving along the QEW in St. Catharines last September. He had apparently become confused, drove down an on-ramp by accident, and struck debris on highway. That same month, an elderly woman was killed in a crash while riding her scooter in Alliston, Ontario. In June, an 89-year-old man was seriously injured in a collision with a car while crossing Main Street West. Under the Highway Traffic Act, powered mobility device users are considered pedestrians. They are not allowed to ride on roads with sidewalks, with the exception of crosswalks. But the Act also prohibits motorized vehicles on sidewalks, so they're in a gray zone. Jan Street, sales supervisor at C&DC Orthopedic Services on Barton Street East, says she often hears remarks about people who don't need scooters. But she says a physical ailment is not always apparent. A person riding a scooter may appear able-bodied, but debilitating conditions can't always be seen. Some people say, I saw this guy riding a scooter and then he jumped off and went in a store. People with chronic conditions have good days and bad days. On their bad days, they probably aren't out of their house. The city says mobility devices keep people active, engaged in the community who might otherwise be housebound. The city's updating its barrier-free standards, and sidewalk widths will be discussed at the city and provincial level as the number of scooters grows. Now, that's just a sampling of a full-page article by Meredith McLeod. It doesn't do justice to the article on September 25th, Saturday Spectator, but it contains a quote by scooter user Bruce Anderson, which isn't true. Bruce rides down from his Upper Sherman home on the bus and scoots around the lower city and even out to Stony Creek, according to McLeod. He thinks more scooters are on sidewalks now because they're a cheap way to get around, especially when bus rides are free for the disabled. Now, if you have a disability, you know bus rides aren't free for you unless your disability is visible. And that excludes maybe half, maybe more of the people with disabilities in Hamilton. I don't know if it seems fair to you, but it certainly doesn't seem fair that the Spectator should be telling us that our bus rides are free when, in fact, we pay the same as our lawyers and our dentists. And have a break if we can work, but because we're disabled, a lot of us don't qualify. So I suggest you write to the Spectator on Fridge Street and tell them what you think of them telling you bus rides are free. It sounds a little to me like legal aid is free, or to suppose that people gain an advantage from being disabled turns attention away from the fact that most of what's administered to them is evicting them, sickening them, and killing them. Yes, early deaths are a statistical certainty for people with low incomes or people with uncertain housing. Simply by implying such an advantage as bus rides are free for the disabled, when for many of the disabled they are not, the Spectator risks being perceived as one of the many for whom our dying is their living. I'm sorry there isn't time this week for our usual going out piece. This is all the news Disrespect has. We'll be back next week. Remember, there will be more. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net.
That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.